take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about.
Yes, back in 1967, John Farnham released his first hit, Johnny Farnham, as he was known then. Sadie the Cleaning Lady, The Graduate, had everyone talking at the movies, and miniskirts were in. It was a year of big changes in Australia and around the world. Money was flowing, creative juices were firing. Australia was at a turning point. Australia was grappling with big questions about the treatment of Indigenous people, capital punishment and political directions. So what were you up to in 1967? Give me a call. Tell me about it. 1-300-800-222. Now we're going to do a quick look at some of the things that were making news. 1967 was the year that Australia voted in a referendum that had been more than 10 years in the making.
Why has it taken the white Australians just on 200 years to recognise us as a race of people?
The time has come when Australia can no longer tolerate legal racial discrimination against its Indigenous people.
It's a matter of democratic right.
With ads featuring cute babies and simple slogans like Vote Yes for Aborigines, the campaign tapped into growing concern about the plight of Indigenous people. Australia voted yes with an overwhelming 91% to recognise Indigenous people as equals, counting Indigenous people in the census and allowing the federal government to make laws concerning them. As a result, it's a result that's all the more remarkable, isn't it, given that we don't have a very good track record when it comes to passing referendums. In other news,
the ringleader is 41-year-old Ronald Ryan.
Sentence of death will be carried out at 8 a.m. on Friday, the 3rd of February, 1967.
This is probably the first time for many, many, many years that Parliament House in Victoria has been attacked in this way.
Every enlightened community in the world has abandoned capital punishment.
A tyrannical premier has forced ministers into submission to his outrageous obsession to hang Ryan.
I was quite sure the gun didn't go off.
It's knife for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Yeah, Ronald Ryan became the last man legally executed in Australia in February 1967. He'd been found guilty of shooting and killing a prison guard during his escape from Pentridge. His death sentence by hanging sparked huge protests against capital punishment. That same month, the Australian Labor Party got a new leader.
I would think that the attitude that we should take in the Labor Party is to question everything that is being done in Australia by our governments. We shouldn't be smug about any item of our performance in Australia. We just can't be. We're too isolated.
Now, before the year was out, however, there was a far more dramatic political story about Prime Minister Harold Holt. Here's how the breaking news was reported on that fateful day in December.
Here is a news flash from the Herald Sun newsroom. An intense land, air and sea search is continuing near Portsea's back beach for the Prime Minister, Mr. Holt. Reporter David Johnson is on the scene, and we cross to Portsea now.
This is David Johnson reporting from Portsea. Australia's Prime Minister, Mr. Harold Holt, is missing. At 12 o'clock today, he went for a swim on the ocean side of the Portsea beach with a friend, Alan Stewart of Armidale. A few moments later, Alan Stewart realised that he could no longer see the Prime Minister, and has then given the alarm. That was at 12 o'clock today. At the moment, there is much activity down here at Portsea. The Army is in charge of the whole operation. We'll have much more information for you as we get it, but a search is underway now. Local people, three helicopters have been called in. Lots of local boats have been employed in the search also. That is about all I can tell you at the moment. Just repeating that Australia's Prime Minister, Harold Holt, is missing.
You can't get much bigger news, can you, than the Prime Minister going missing. I wonder if you remember where you were when you heard that news. Now, before we get to the music, the film, the fashion that shaped the year 1967, which we will do soon with cultural studies expert John Stratton, there are a few lesser-known events of 1967 that we thought it would be fun to draw your attention to. Now, historian Claire Wright's been digging around in the archives to bring you a collection of small but significant changes that start to tell a story about where Australia was headed in 1967. Claire's a professor of history at La Trobe University. She's with us now. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Now, I know you weren't around at the time, but you have put together this wonderful list of changes, new laws, some announcements, some different systems we adopted in 1967. When you're trying to get a sense of what the country was like at this particular time, why do you go beyond the big news? Like, why do these micro developments, why are they important to look at too?
Yeah, I was born in 1969, so obviously 1967 is ancient history to me. But it's, you know, we all know from our living our daily lives that it's the small things that are going on around us that often are making the most impact on us, but also that just form the context of our times. And for an historian looking back, I think that going into often can be forensic detail, but about smaller things can give you more of a sense of the patterns, of the rhythms, of some of the attitudinal changes that are going on in the ways that history is made beyond those events that tend to then get remembered as being the big headline-grabbing ones, you know, the prime minister that went missing or the last man hanged, or obviously those are incredibly important things, but sometimes they're the firsts or the lasts, and that's a different part of the intellectual process working as opposed to the smaller dot joining exercises that can give us more of a rich textured nature of the times.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of those things. There was, for example, in 1967, a change to Australian passports. What was that change?
Yeah, well, federal cabinet decided to drop the word British from the cover of Australian passports, and it agreed that it would have to amend the Nationality and Citizenship Act to change the designation of British subject on the inside of passports. So it's interesting that Australia was actually one of the last Commonwealth nations to drop it. Canada and New Zealand already had, but so. People of my parents' generation, my parents were actually American, but for all of those Australians before 1967, they were designated British subjects and travelled on British passports.
Wow. What were the other changes then? Because there were some, I think, that signalled that Australia was extricating itself gradually from Britain around this time.
Yeah, that's the kind of subtle dot joining exercise. So, for example, in March of 1967, the Royal Australian Navy replaced the British white ensign flag on all of its ships with the Australian white ensign. And the first vessel to carry the white Australian flag was called the Boonaroo. And it was actually a ship that was commissioned during the Vietnam War and had a little of its own controversy in 1967 because the Maritime Union refused to crew it because of the cargo that it was carrying. But just that little shift, again, the first ship with an Australian white ensign. In August that year, Qantas dropped the word Empire from its name. And it had had that name since 1934 when it partnered with Britain's Imperial Airways to fly between Australia and the UK. So
what was it called then?
Subtle shift.
Was it Qantas Empire, or what was the name?
Qantas Empire Airlines.
Oh, wow.
And so dropping the name actually coincided with introducing jumbo jets and expanding operations. So at that time, where international air travel was starting to become somewhat more democratized by these other changes, Australia's also flagging the fact that it is a nation in its own right and not just flying to the center of empire when Australians leave Australian shores.
I've got Claire Wright with me. Claire's a professor of history at La Trobe University, and we're talking about some of the smaller stories from 1967 that don't jump out at you in the history books, but as Claire's saying, they're an important part of painting the picture of the way that we were changing. Now, I love this one. This is when the postcode system started in Australia.
I know, right? Like just these things that we take for granted as being just part of quotidian texture of our lives, our postcode system, those four little digits that we put on our letters and mostly now our packages that we get from online shopping, since we don't send letters very much anymore, well, they all started in 1967.
So how did they do it before we had postcodes?
Well, before 1967, the mail delivery system really relied on the skilled sorting staff who just knew where every suburb was. But it was an indication that by 1967, Australia was growing so rapidly, you know, that urban expansion, that suburban boom, the housing boom of that post-war generation, that there were by now 8,000 delivery offices. So it was getting harder and harder and requiring more and more skilled staff to do all of the stages of the sorting. So basically postcodes just simplified that process. And I guess now it's AI.
And something we picked up too, Claire, and obviously the postcodes were second, but your postcode, whatever state you're in, the first number of the postcode, it usually aligns with the first number of the old, you know, analog radio station. So in Victoria, there was 3LO, and the postcards are all, the postcodes all start with a 3. In South Australia, it's 5. The postcard starts with a 5. I assume that's not a coincidence.
Yeah, well, again, that simplifies the process. And actually, I don't know which numbers were chosen for which states, like why Victoria became 3. There's an interesting research project. I'm sure one of your listeners already knows and will ring in quick smart. But I am old enough to remember 3LO and 3AW and indeed analog radios. And so that, again, it just sort of became part of the tribalism of the states, which number you were associated with.
Of course, plenty of people still listening, I think. There must be a few still listening to analog radio. Certainly, we're still on analog for sure. Now, the 6 o'clock swill, oh, people might remember that. I certainly have heard of it. That was the rush to drink as much as possible between finishing work and the pubs closing at 6. In South Australia, there were some changes to that in 1967.
Well, South Australia is actually the last state to change its early closing hours. Now, this is a subject that I could talk to you about for the next 4 hours, because pub history is part of the DNA of my expertise as an historian. My first book was called Beyond the Ladies' Lounge, about Australia's female publicans. So 6 o'clock closing came in as a temporary wartime measure in the First World War as an austerity measure to in sympathy with the troops overseas who were doing it hard. And it was the temperance movement had been for generations attempting to get those early closing hours, but the First World War gave them the trigger that the governments finally agreed with them. And that was supposed to be a temporary wartime measure, but indeed it was extended beyond the war and just became part of the fabric of Australia's drinking culture, was that pubs closed at 6, people knocked off work at 5, so that there was that last hour of the day that was that hard and fast perpendicular drinking that made pubs very much a site of male drinking and ushered in that whole era of the ladies' lounge. Now, that all started to change in around the 50s, when the incivility of that style of drinking was really criticised, and Australia wanted to become more cosmopolitan like they drank in Europe. And so it started in the 50s, but South Australia was the last state to change 6 o'clock closing in 1967.
We are going to stay in South Australia because at that year, 67, was also the beginning of Don Dunster's time as Premier, a very, very memorable Premier. I mean, I grew up in Adelaide, so even though he was no longer the Premier, stories about him just abounded everywhere. What made him so memorable?
Yeah, so on the 1st of June, Don Dunson succeeded Frank Walsh as the Premier. And Don Dunson might be so memorable because of the pink safari shorts that he wore that you now can go and see in the Democracy Museum in Adelaide. If you want to catch a good look at those tiny little shorts that were part of his well-known safari suits. And that is just, I think, a great measure of this colourful premier who really did usher in a new age. You know, we tend to think of the swinging 60s and associate that era of progressive reform, of civil rights, of really the end of that long, slow post-war Menzies era as being part of the 60s. But they didn't really come until the very end of the 60s and into the early 70s. And Don Dunstan's style of reforming really went beyond South Australia. He took on the Conservatives. He really tried to move the country forward. He campaigned against the White Australia policy. And I think in particular the thing that he's most remembered for was that he really loved arts and culture. And he put a lot of effort into resourcing them in particular. And I think that we can now see this in things like Adelaide Writers Week, which is such a much loved part of the literary culture in Australia and is still the only free, totally free literature festival in Australia. And, you know, I think we can remember that legacy and take some take a lead from it. Just because something comes to an end doesn't mean it wasn't a good idea, and maybe putting back some of that focus on arts and culture as being real part of our social cohesion and part of the social fabric of a nation is really important to remember.
Mm. And just another thing to note about Don Dunstan, I mean, it wasn't for another 8 years, but he took South Australia to be the first state to decriminalise homosexuality as well. So yeah, he certainly did a lot for progressive causes. Claire Wright is here. We're just talking about some of the things that you might not remember from 1967, but are very important nonetheless. Now, in Australia, the government was resisting pressure to ban the oral contraceptive pill. How significant was that for women?
Oh, well, incredibly significant. And as I say, this was the era of civil rights and women's rights, and the first we were on the brink of the second wave women's movement, of the women's liberation movement, and this is really a symbol of it, the fact that women could finally be liberated from the fear of pregnancy for their sexual activities, and they were able to participate with their whole bodies and have control over their whole bodies in ways that generations of women, right back to the first wave of feminists, really, were advocating to do. So the fact that Australia didn't succumb to pressures that some of the other countries did to ban the oral contraceptive pill, really on moral grounds, was where those bans were coming, that it would be the end of society, that it would destroy the fabric of society if women were able to be sexually liberated. And on the 4th of April, Australian government announced that it wouldn't ban the oral contraceptive pill, maintaining that the risk of thrombosis, which was the kind of scientific reason that was being used as to stall the introduction of this progressive reform, they maintained the risk was very slight. So it still wasn't easy to get. You had to be married, you had to get a doctor to sign off, and it came with a very heavy tax, medical misogyny and patriarchy being what it is. But it was a very important move that did in many ways usher in the next wave of reforms for women.
Mm. Now, finally, Claire, you are a professor of history at La Trobe University, and one of the other things that happened in 1967 was the opening of La Trobe University. Was this a sign of a thriving higher education sector in Australia at the time?
Yeah, I know. This is going to sound a bit like special pleading here to flag the opening of my employer of the last two decades, but it is a really good indicator that this is a time where there was a massive expansion of tertiary education. Other universities like Monash in Victoria as well, and then numerous ones around the country were opening up. And importantly, having this layer of tertiary educations beyond the traditional sandstone universities, what we now call the Group of Eight, was an important social progressive move, because the people who tended to go to these universities were the ones who had previously been locked out of higher education. So these are what we now call first in families, a lot of women, migrants, Aboriginal students. These were all people who were being enrolled in great numbers in these universities like La Trobe, who had previously been locked out of higher education. And so that massive expansion of that era, your style guru coming in might want to talk about the brutalist architecture that La Trobe is built in, which is also a symbol of its age. Just is an indication of that democratizing of education. And at a time where we are seeing record lows in the investment in tertiary education in Australia and the massive reliance on international students and the fragility that has instituted into our now very corporatized university sector, I think it's, again, important to remember that there was this era where there was, like in arts and culture, where there was on the brink of a great lot of reforms and hope for the sort of country that Australia could be and the sort of independence and freedom that it could show. And indeed, Gough Whitlam epitomised that when he is elected a few years later, that the sort of independence of mind and faith and spirit in the country that this expansion in tertiary education, I think, is a really good indicator.
Yeah. Claire, thank you so much for taking us through some of the stories of 1967 that we might not always pop up in the history books, but nonetheless, as you say, paint a really interesting picture of where we were. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Professor Claire Wright, who's a professor of history at La Trobe University. On Nightlife on ABC Radio, you're with Suzanne Hill on this Saturday night. We're taking a trip back in time to 1967. What memories do you have? Stock Girl from Palmerston says, I was 14 in third year of high school. I wasn't into the Beatles. I remember hearing about the hanging of Ronald Ryan on the radio while I was on the school bus. Heather, just that comment we were making about postcodes, said the postcode numbers also aligned with the old STD phone prefixes, i.e. 03 for Melbourne. See, Heather, it only works actually for Sydney and Melbourne. Everywhere else it doesn't work because South Australia doesn't work in South Australia, which has the fives for the postcodes, but it has eights on the radio stations. And so it was a bit confusing there. And I've sussed out the reason why. It was because four got given to regional New South Wales, five got given to regional Victoria. So it just works for Sydney and Melbourne. The rest of it got a bit confused. We had, a few more people coming in. We would love to get you on the phones, 1-300-800-222. And we're going to talk to John Stratton in just a moment. Now, Michael's given us a call from Sydney. Good evening, Michael.
Hello there.
What do you remember about 1967?
Well, that was my last year of school, and that was the first year that the Wyndham scheme finished. It had their finishing year. So prior to that, it used to be called fifth year, and the students did the leaving certificate in fifth year, but we were the first year to do the high school certificate in year 12 now.
Right, so you had to stay an extra year than what you originally thought you would have had to. Well,
we were senior boys for 2 years. It was a bonus.
Yeah, there was no one above you.
I went to Cogamaris Brothers. It was all boys, so we had another year on us, in the school environment, and it was fantastic fun.
Yeah. All right, Michael, what was your favourite song from 1967? Do you remember?
Oh, dear, I've only got to remember. I'm at that stage. Now, look, there's not many of them. but it would have been Beatles, The Animals, I can't recall them.
Yeah. All right, Michael, but your big memory is staying the extra year at high school.
It's a big thing. Yeah, sure.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing that with us, Michael. Lovely to hear from you. Yeah, it was the summer of love. It was the year that pop and rock music really came into its own. The Beatles, as Michael was just saying, think Doors, think Van Morrison. Hollywood produced films like The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde. In fashion, the hemlines were getting shorter, the fabric was getting more colourful, more people were embracing the hippie look. So to take us through some of the trends of 1967, I'm delighted to have Professor John Stratton with me. He's a Professor of Cultural Studies at the University of Adelaide. Hello, John.
Hello, Suzanne. Good to be with you.
1967 in a nutshell for you, John, what would it be?
Well, what was I doing in 1967? Well, I was at boarding school in England. Television was black and white. Colour television began to come in that year in England. About three quarters of British homes had television. Z cars replaced Dixon of Dock Green on television. It was a much more violent police procedural. And indeed, my friends weren't allowed to watch it. They would come down to my house, my parents' house, to watch it. I was listening to Disraeli Gears by Cream and A Hard Road by John Mayall's Blues Breakers. That's the album with Peter Green, who joined after Eric Clapton left. I persuaded an aunt to buy me Jefferson Aeroplane's Surrealistic Pillow for my birthday. She had to get it imported. I bought the Doors' first album. I still have both these vinyl LPs, though the Doors album is a bit scratched now. And a year later, Jefferson Aeroplane and the Doors played a double bill at the Roundhouse in London, but my parents wouldn't let me go.
Oh, drats. Yeah. I mean, so much music coming out, John. What was it about 1967 that made the year such a huge kind of creative moment, particularly in the UK and the US?
Well, I think the key thing, you know, the key thing about that in both countries and indeed in Australia was the post-war baby boom. What we're talking about is the baby boomers reaching, you know, late teens, early 20s, and beginning to think for themselves, if you like, as opposed to what their parents thought. So this is a time when you get the beginnings of what was called then the generation gap. And in America, what you get is the rejection of the suburban ideal, along with a rejection of the nuclear family, a mum, dad, two kids, and a rejection of consumerism. Strangely, in Britain, well, not perhaps not strangely, but in Britain, you get the opposite. Consumerism is celebrated. That's what Swinging London was about. So when people talk about the hippies and how, you know, and the rejection of consumerism, they're really just talking about America. In Britain, it was quite different.
That's so interesting. And then in Australia, John, I know that there was a sense that our cultural revolution was still a few years away.
Yes, what happened here, and you have to remember the Vietnam War's going on at this time. What happened here, a drain of creative thinkers right through the 1960s. People like Richard Neville, Richard Walsh, Martin Sharp, Germaine Greer left for England in 1964. Robert Hughes left the same year. Barry Humphries left in 1959, and lots of other creative workers left. John Bluthal, the actor, left in 1960. So there's a lot of reasons why that kind of cultural flowering didn't occur in Australia in the same way as it did in America or in the UK, though it happened, as I say, in both those countries quite differently.
Now, John, I might go to a couple of callers and then we'll come back and get into some of the music of 1967 with you. Hello, Karen in Margate.
Hello, how are you?
Well, now tell me what you remember about 1967. What were you up to?
I particularly remember when Harold Holt disappeared. And, you know, there was a whole lot of hoo-ha. Well, it wasn't hoo-ha. It was in the news for weeks and weeks and weeks, and people thought there were all sorts of theories about who might have taken him, you know, no one ever said that he drowned naturally. There was all sorts of conspiracy theories and so on and so forth. And it was wonderful. I was aching to vote because you couldn't vote till you were 21. And I remember voting in the election that gave made Aborigine citizens. You know, it was so wonderful.
And so you, if you'd been, what, a year or two younger, you couldn't have taken part in that particular vote.
No,
so
you
got there.
No,
you were old enough.
And I wanted to vote in previous elections when I was 18. I couldn't because I'm a political person, you know. But it was really, that was really great, yes.
And I think you had a baby that year too, Karen.
I had a baby that year, yes, yes. It was a wonderful time. They were wonderful times, really, wonderful.
Yeah. Do you remember a particular song that would have been the soundtrack to that time for you?
Oh, no, just everything. I heard last night you played Tom Jones and I was in the bath and I knew every word and I was singing along.
Wonderful. I'm glad we brought back some memories and gave you a bath time sing-along, Karen. Thank you for your memories of 1967. Christine in Canberra, what do you remember?
Well, I was 17 and I was over visiting my sister who was living in Hobart, and it was February, and of course that was the time of the terrible bushfires all across the east coast of Tasmania. And this, I remember the smoke was so thick. My sister had a little Vespa scooter and she took me across the Tasman Bridge and I think we nearly got blown off. But the main thing that I remember is that I could not get back to start my year 12 because the planes were delayed due to the smoke. So I had an extra day off school. And then I remember when I finally did get back home, landing at Essendon Airport, and my brother was picking me up and he greeted me with the news that, by the way, next Saturday you and I are singing on Kevin Dennis's New Faces.
Oh!
And we
now,
did.
I don't know Kevin Dennis's New Faces. What was it?
Oh, it was a live talent show. You had to be up, it was really live. You were on at 7:30 in the morning. And I remember he said we were both a very fresh young couple and I won $10.
Was that a really big deal in 1967?
Oh, yeah. I remember I went out and bought myself an electric blanket.
For $10?
Yep.
Okay, that tells the story. And how did your career go after that, Christine?
When you were talking about the music of the time, I knew every Peter, Paul and Mary song. I used to sing all the alto lines to that, and that's what I thought I was going to do, tour Australia singing. But I didn't. I went to Teachers College and spent 45 years in music education in primary.
Well, you probably got to do plenty of singing along those years, though.
Oh, yeah, and I'm still singing. No. Still singing.
Christine, thank you so much for calling.
No, they were good time.
Yeah. Very nice to hear from you. If you would like to add your picture, you know, a piece of the puzzle of what was happening in Australia in 1967, 1-300-800-222 is the number to give us a call. Julie in Perth just saying, yeah, the Black Tuesday fires in southern Tasmania were on the 7th of Feb 1967. Mid-year, I achieved double figures. I turned 10. I took my first visit to the mainland. I had my first time in an aeroplane. Our family stayed in Surfers Paradise. I got the courage to jump into the swimming pool, i.e. not using the ladder or the steps. Lots of lovely memories, very formative memories from Julie in Perth. Now, John Stratton's with us, Professor of Cultural Studies at the University of Adelaide. Okay, talk to us about some of the music of 1967 what were the big hits in Australia, John?
Oh, well, big hits here. Well, the Easy Beats. We've got to talk about Friday on My Mind, which was released in 1967, but was the biggest selling of it was in 1968. But Friday on My Mind was written by Harry Vander and George Young, both members of the Easy Beats. It was produced by Shel Tamy, who was an American working as an independent producer in London. And it was just the most massive hit. Other hits from
let me play a bit of it, John, before we move on. Yeah, John, it made number one in Australia, number 18 in America, number 6 in the UK.
Absolutely. It's an Australian working class anthem.
Very much so. Now, we should probably mention John Farnham, or Johnny Farnham, as he was known then.
Hi, Sadie, the cleaning lady. Her aching knee's not getting any younger. Well, her red detergent hands have for years not held a man's, and time would find her heart expired of hunger.
Yeah, it went to number one in Australia. We're all singing about a cleaning lady back in 1967, John.
Yeah, it's a strange song because it sounds like it's a music hall song, but it wasn't. It was actually written by three Americans, and it was picked up. It was knocked back by at least one artist in Australia, and it was picked up by Johnny Farnham's manager at the time. Johnny Farnham was 18, and the song, it sold 180,000 copies. It was the highest selling single in Australia in the 1960s. In fact, it was so important, or so current, if you like, that there was actually an answer song kind of parody that was released in 1968 by a guy called Frankie Davidson, who was a singer and comedian, or an actor as well. He acted in A Country Practice. That parody was called Hector the Trash Collector.
I wonder if any nightlifers remember it. That sounds like it could be fun to dig out. What about the Bee Gees? They're Aussie, of course.
Oh, yes. And they had a hit in 1967 with Massachusetts. Now, Massachusetts, they'd never been to Massachusetts when they wrote that song. It was recorded in London, where the Gibb brothers had moved to be managed by Robert Stigwood, who was not only Australian, you're talking about Adelaide. Robert Stigwood actually came from Adelaide, had moved to London. And, Stigwood's really important. He's much more important than much. He's not that well known. But he produced Saturday Night Fever later on, and Grease.
So it had been written to be offered to the Seekers, apparently. But they.
That's right.
They didn't want the, it.
No, they didn't get it, didn't get to them.
Well, good for the Bee Gees.
Actually, much later, Judith Durham did record a version of it. But at the time, no, it didn't get to them. So they recorded it themselves. And, yeah, got to number one in Australia, climbed to number 11 in America.
Mm. The Master's Apprentices, they had Undecided that year. Master's Apprentices were coming out of Adelaide too, weren't they, John?
That's right, they did. And as I say, Undecided was released in 1967, but it didn't do very well until the band moved to Melbourne. And in 1968, it became a really big hit. It peaked at number 13. The B-side of Undecided was Wars or Hands of Time. Now, the thing about that track, which is about a soldier leaving his girlfriend and going to war, is that it's usually thought to be like the first Australian song that referenced the Vietnam War.
How interesting. And then, yeah, it's not one of the more famous ones. Like, you know, I've grown up in a time after this and I've never actually heard of it. But whereas I would know, you know, God help me, I was only 19 and a lot of the others. Now, the Loved Ones had a track called The Loved One. They were formed in Melbourne.
That's right. They were Melbourne. They actually started out as a trad jazz band.
Mm.
And The Loved One was released as a single in 1966. It reached number two on the singles chart, and it was included on the band's fondly remembered album, Magic Box, released also in 1967. The Loved Ones much more influential than their reputation, which is not very big, would have you believe. And In Excess covered The Loved One in 1981.
Now, some more, a couple more SMSs that have come in. I'd love to hear your memories of 1967 nightlife as 1-300-800-222. Kerry Ann from Newcastle says, it was my first year of high school. I was so grown up. I had to travel by bus 7Ks to and from school daily. New friends were made from different schools and suburbs that were feeding into my high school. The school had a yearly fete where they had the local radio station come and entertain us with prizes being given out. I won a 45 record of the Hollies, Carrie Ann. I used to think that it was Carrie Ann and was written for me, says Carrie Ann. Oh, that's nice, isn't it? I've got John Stratton here, a professor of cultural studies at the University of Adelaide. Now, you are a big fan of psychedelic music, John. That was really going off in the late 60s. Here's a reminder of some of these psychedelic songs of 1967.
Shadow fell upon my lonely room. I touched your golden hair and tasted your perfume. Your eyes were filled with love the way they used to be. Your gentle hand reached out to comfort me.
Yes, that was the Electric Prunes, Too Much to Dream, Jefferson Airplane, Somebody to Love, Procol Harum, White a Shade of Pale. John, did that kind of music reflect what was going on in society?
Well, one of the things about 1967 is that LSD, the mind-altering drug, if you like, was becoming, well, basically was becoming commonly used. In San Francisco, the human being, be-in, in 1967 was a protest against it being made illegal, because at that point it wasn't illegal. So there was, a lot of drugs, a lot of psychedelic drugs spreading through society. Of course, this is the story about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, the Beatles track, where the Beatles claimed that it's not a story about a psychedelic trip. It's just about children and, imagination about diamonds and so forth. But yes, you have Timothy Leary in the United States tune in and drop out. Ken Kesey, writing.
Let me tell you, you can recover your memory for a moment. Mary from Mount Gravatt is saying, I arrived a 14-year-old from the UK in May 67, at a school dance soon after the band called for requests. I asked for one of my favourites at the time, Sonny and Cher, River Deep, Mountain High. Who? What? No one had heard of it. I won't mention the cold, the coldest we'd ever felt. June in Brisbane in a Queenslander house with no central heating, says Mary. Oh, all right, what were some of the other big hits?
I think the one of the things to say about Australian popular music at that time was that it was very white. And, of course, River Deep, Mountain High is Sonny and Cher's version is very white. But you get, like, The Master's Apprentices, riffing on the Rolling Stones rather than on R&B at the time. So there's this lack of information about black music in Australia.
Now, just because I'm looking at the clock, I want to make sure that it's not all about the music. If we get time, we'll come back to it. But just talk to us a bit about, John, the fashion of 1967. How much was the fashion influenced by what was going on in the music world?
Well, it's more the other way around. I mean, what was going on in fashion, if you think about, again, you think about England in particular, because as I say, England, there was a celebration of consumerism. So you have boutiques. The first boutique really in the UK was Mary Quant's Bazaar in 1955. But by 1967, you have about 2,000 boutiques in London. And what you have is this attempt by young people not to look like their parents. They don't want to look like miniature images of what their parents looked like. They want to look new and different. And so you get, as I say, you get these new boutiques. Granny Takes a Trip, which opened in 1966, but was really big in 1967. And it was visited by Mick Jagger, by Jimi Hendrix, all sorts of major popular music figures who were buying these clothes that they then displayed on stage.
And that's then, I guess, made it way back onto the streets and, what people were wearing. Was the miniskirt actually, when did the miniskirt have its moment?
Well, the miniskirt's really important in 1967. It begins earlier. I mean, some people say that Mary Quant originated the miniskirt, but she herself has said no. What she did was pick up on a trend that was happening, and what she did was popularize the miniskirt. So you get through the later part of the 1960s, you get hemlines getting shorter and shorter, basically 4-5 inches above the knee.
Now, some more of your SMSs. Brett says 67 was the year that Normie Rowe did his national service and went to Vietnam. Someone else is saying, we arrived in August 1967 as 10-pound Poms. I was 11 years old. I came to the Northern Beaches. I still live here. I remember listening to music on 2SM. Mary Mary by the Monkees was my favourite. My brothers and I are eternally grateful for the opportunities we've been given. And a shout-out to my brother Brian, who listens to Nightlife from his home in northern New South Wales. G'day, Brian. Ah, yes, okay. Timothy Leary, John, the slogan was turn on, tune in.
Drop out.
That's right. Dates precisely as my texter to January 67, just months before the summer of love. Sharon says, I'm loving this. I was only 8 and living in New Zealand, but I'm loving all the history and the music is fab. Michael says you can't talk about 67 without mentioning surfing. By then, surfing had become huge in Australia, especially on the East Coast. Surfboards were becoming shorter from the Malibu boards. There was a lot of experimentation in board design and, of course, the surfing music. The Beach Boys. In 67, I graduated from Sydney Uni. I began working. Jenny in Victoria says, I was 19, married. I just had my second baby. My husband was a public servant. We bought our first home in Canberra for $14,000. Whoa. Everyone would be envying that today. I had to give up my public service typing job when I got married, so I was stuck at home with no phone or TV, and I hadn't yet got my driver's license. I filled my time listening to the radio, making clothes for my boys, and reading. And then 3 years later, I also had twins. Now, John, what were the movies of 1967?
Oh, Lordy, there were so many and so many really important, good ones. You've mentioned The Graduate. Which included, talking of music, which included Simon and Garfunkel's Mrs. Robinson. There was The Producers, which was written and directed by Mel Brooks, starred Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel. It's a film about a mild-mannered accountant and a con artist theatre producer who schemed to get rich by fraudulently overselling shares in a stage musical designed to fail. It didn't fail, and that's the humour of the producers. Bonnie and Clyde, I think you mentioned Bonnie and Clyde, a sort of semi-biographical crime drama directed by Arthur Penn. That was really important. To Sir With Love, an English film, directed by James Clavell, who had been born in Australia but moved with his parents to England when he was quite young. And it starred Sidney Poitier. Now, Sidney Poitier, it might sound like an odd choice because people think of Sidney Poitier as American. But Sidney Poitier actually came from Guyana originally. And so in the film, he's come, if I remember correctly, he comes from the Bahamas. So he's a part of that Caribbean migration to Britain in the 1950s, 1960s.
Of course. Now, John, I just would love to squeeze Mary in very quickly. Hopefully I'll have a moment to come back to you. Mary, hello.
Oh, hello, Suzanne.
Yeah, what's your memory of
dedicated nightlife?
Oh, good.
No, what I was just saying to your producer is that what we probably are missing is that I was 18 in 1967, and what we have now is anything that happens overseas is on our TV in an instant. We didn't have that in 1967. We had people that we were listening to, you know, Elvis, Beatles. We didn't know what they looked like.
Because that's right, you didn't see them on TV unless you had one, and I guess that was
no
a privilege
TV.
There. Goodness me. Now, Mary, I would love to have talked longer, but we're right on the final minute of the hour, so alas, we can't. But thank you. A lovely point, well made. And John, thank
Suzanne,
you.
Suzanne, can I just mention, talking of coming from the UK, 1965, 2 years earlier, Jean Shrimpton had caused a massive sensation in conservative Australia.
At the Melbourne
Cup. When she wore
Cup.
A shift dress. Yes.
Very famous moment in Australian history. Hey, John, I'm sure we could probably talk for another hour about 1967, but may I thank you for being with us here on Nightlife tonight.
It's been a pleasure, Suzanne.
There's John Stratton, Professor of Cultural Studies at the University of Adelaide. Thanks for all your calls.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.